It's Christmas, finally December. Are we all in the Christmas spirit?
I've been in the Christmas spirit for weeks.
I've literally been in the Christmas spirit since like October.
Like Day Hawkeye started.
Cause he's just like I watch the Doctor Who Christmas specials all the time anyway, so it's always Christmas. I watched Love Actually in July this year. Like, you know, you gotta do it.
I have a note in my calendar for May next year to watch Nightmare Before Christmas, just to annoy Sammy.
Why? Because it's a summer film.
Yeah, absolutely. This is summer.
That sounds like the equivalent of saying that Die Hard's not a Christmas film. Mm. Saying that it's a Halloween film. I think that's the line. I think that's a fair line to not cross. Anyway, so in the essence of Christmas, we're going to talk about Christmas films. First, we're going to talk about each of our favourite ones. And then we're going to maybe suggest that we go and watch some lesser known ones that people tend to skip over. Because people always tend to go for like Love Actually and the ones we're going to go on about. But it's like there are loads of like experimental Christmas films out there that I think that more people should go and watch. I haven't picked an experimental Christmas film recently. I've just picked another Scrooge film. But, you know, whatever. Sammy.
Me.
What is your favourite Halloween film?
You?
Sorry. What was
God
your favourite?
Damn it, Reese. There's a line, okay, that we've drawn in the snow, and you are not to cross that line. But my number one film, one of my all-time favourite films, and my favourite Christmas film, is A Nightmare Before Christmas. The concept is one of the most unique and engaging ones I've ever seen in, like, any medium. It's just so wild and so out there, I think. Having the stop motion animation and like the thousands of hours of manual labor that they put into this film, just A is just so impressive, but I think it also adds so much character to the film, and especially where you have the residents of Halloween, obviously in this sort of very gothic, elongated caricature manner. I think it just pairs so well with that and just elevates the whole thing. I think Danny Elfman is one of cinema's all-time greatest composers, and he does it.
And singers,
because he is the singing voice of Jack Skellington. But Chris...
Is he?
Yeah.
And
Chris Sarandon is a fantastic voice for him.
But my assumption would be that every character is played by Johnny Depp or Helena Bonham Carter.
Neither of them in this. Neither of them in this film, because it's not.
Because it's not
O'Hara.
A Tim Burton.
It's Burton in sort of like
Tim
name.
Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas.
So he wrote the a poem that this is based on, and then he gave it to Henry Selick, I believe.
But it's got so many Tim Burton actors in it.
Oh yes, of
Catherine
course.
Catherine O'Hara is Sally. Paul Reubens shows up, who was in Batman Returns and Pee Wee's Adventures. Frank Welker, Frank Welker does the voice of every moving thing. So.
Scooby Doo and
animated
Fred.
Character ever has been played by Frank Welker.
Also, so. I think I really like, it's got so many great cameos as well. Yeah, it's got like Greg Proop shows up, and Patrick Stewart like. Records a narration.
Patrick Stewart's one is only on the official soundtrack. It's not the intro to the actual film. They had someone else do that, which always really threw me because I listened to this like extensively in December. So I got used to the Patrick Stewart one. And then when I watched the actual film, I was like, wait a minute, this isn't the real version. But it was. I looked up after.
The film only lasts about 2 minutes, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it's quite a quick film.
Yeah,
it's not
it gets
a lot.
It gets to the third act so quickly.
But I don't mind
like
that.
When I first watched it,
things
I was
don't
like,
have to be no, long like, to be good.
Not in a bad way. No, I it's a great film. I can't deny it. But when I watched it, I was like, it finished. And I was like, oh, okay. But no, it's delightful. It's very good.
I've only seen this film twice. I didn't like it the first time. I didn't like it the first time I saw it because I saw it in like a room full of people who were singing along to it.
Yeah,
and I couldn't understand what was going on.
Good way
on
to watch it.
Everyone
once
was
you've seen it.
But the next time I watched it on my laptop, and like all the lights are off.
Yeah,
like, so like, just a little screen of it, and it was like, and I was bopping along to it. It's good fun, isn't it? It's not my favorite Henry Selick film. I really like James and the Giant Peach. I think that's a really underrated film.
Sadly not seen. It's been on my list for so long to watch.
It's a bloody terrifying film if you're like eight. And it's still bloody terrifying. Of course, it did Coraline as well.
I've only seen Nightmare Before Christmas once because me and Sammy made a trade a few years ago that I would finally watch Nightmare Before Christmas and he would finally watch
It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life. And I think we both got rewarded. Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Is he Oogie Boogie, the villain? He's
Oogie
great.
Boogie, fantastic. I love the mishmash of monsters. You have the trick-or-treaters, Shock, Lock and Barrel.
We were great.
They're just the songs are also all.
Although I've only seen it once, I've also played the Kingdom Hearts level that's based on it, where Sora, Donald, and Goofy get Halloween Town style designs, but then when you go to Christmas Town, it doesn't change. So you're still in the Halloween ones, and that's fun. But it's really irritating that This Is Halloween plays non-stop the whole time you're there. So you get just stuck in your head.
Sorry, I could recite most of this music.
It's my favourite song in it.
I don't know if I could rank the songs in this. I love them all so much. They're just so perfect for the moment that they're in. Every song lands for me. Like Kidnap the Sandy Claws. Oh, what a bop. Oh, I just love this film.
As is done by studios too much these days, would you say there is a better version of this film and a worse version of this film?
Oh, I certainly would, Mike. Thanks for reminding me that it exists. So in, I believe it was 2005 or 2006, Disney, I believe, digitalized the film and then put that into circulation.
Why would you do it?
Why?
Because stop motion is so impressive.
Stop motion is so impressive and it's holding up so well. So just like, I remember watching it.
Hang on. When you say digitalized, do you
made it CG
version? Not just perk it up?
No, they they CG'd the whole thing and then released that. And I remember watching one year, it was on the telly, and being like, this doesn't seem right. And everyone was like, no, this is the only one version, this is it. And I was like, nah. And I went off, and I spent ages, because I was young and I didn't get how stuff works. And I was just like, hang on a minute, I've cracked it. This isn't stop motion and it looks, it doesn't look bad, it's... But the highs of that stop motion are you're not going to replicate that because it adds so much gothic charm to this gothic tale, and it's just,
were there unnecessary CG monsters or animals just walking across the front of the screen?
I don't know. I only watch the DVD that I've got of it now, which thankfully is the stop motion.
And little well known fact, but Jack from Sorry Meadows is actually Jack Skellington. We got him in.
And he says he's from a Halloween film. So.
We're not having this conversation.
Let's move on from one out of season film to another that has nothing to do with Christmas either.
A lie.
Because I don't know why you think that this dumb action film is the best film ever. Because I can think of so many reasons why I hate Die Hard.
And another reason, I hit two police officers named Jansen. If anyone wants to hear more community references like that, go and listen to Intermediate Studies of Podcasts and Originality, our community rewatch podcast featuring us three and Jack Skellington. Not as Reese has said, I've picked Die Hard. It's not actually my all-time favorite Christmas film, because I think my all-time favorite Christmas film is also Reese's. So I've let him pick it so I can talk about Die Hard. I think the debate about whether it's a Christmas film has died down a lot since the writer of the film came out and said, yes, I wrote it intended to be a Christmas film. It's John trying to rekindle his relationship with his family on Christmas so he can come home for Christmas, spend Christmas with his daughter, but the Christmas office party gets attacked by terrorists. Most people have seen Die Hard. It's just bloody brilliant, isn't it? It's one of four Christmas films I tend to watch every year. There's the one that Reese is going to talk about. There's Elf. There's Home Alone and there's Die Hard. Usually me, my dad, my brother watch Die Hard together. And I think the last 2 years, my sister and mum joined in as well, because it's just so good. I think it works just as like probably one of the best like straightforward action films of all time, just because the script is so good. And I think the combination of the writing for John and Bruce Willis's performance make him just the most perfectly unlikable Christmas star, the most perfectly unlikable character just ever. He's such a dick, but he's so easy to watch because he's so awful. And then like Hans Gruber, just a fantastic villain. Alan Rickman's so good in it. And just like, it's so iconic. The script in it is just like fantastic. So many iconic lines that like when you're watching it, you can't help but like speak along to some of the scenes. And the action, again, all pretty iconic. Obviously you've got ho ho ho, now I have a machine gun. Just brilliant. And it's an action film that sort of combines in Christmas like production design, because usually Christmas films are going to be rom-coms, and until last year I didn't really watch many of them. Now I do. It's too many. this is an action film where like the whole soundtrack is Christmas songs, and there's Christmas trees everywhere, and when he's driving through LA there's Christmas decorations, and it's just got such an amazing supporting cast. The two officers named Jansen, yeah, fantastic. Die Hard 1 and 2 are very much, this is a franchise about Bruce Willis gets trapped in one location with terrorists, and like in the first one, it's one tower, and that's great. Then the second one, it's an airport, which is a little bit bigger. Then after that, they just ditch it and go like big. Like the second one is a whole city. The third one's a whole city. The fourth one is two cities.
Yeah, but the third one is like puzzles and stuff.
Yeah, third one is great. But then like actually, the Die Hard films take a long time to get bad.
Honestly, my like introduction to like Die Hard was for Die Hard 3, like it was like a maths problem we just watched in class. Yeah, the one where it's like there's a 3 liter
the water
bottle
and
a 5 liter bottle. You need to get 4 liters. You're just like, this is fucking easy.
Samuel L. Jackson and Bruce Willis yelling at each other about the fact they can't do maths. It's just fantastic. It's a great franchise. It takes until the fourth one before they stop being great, and it takes until the fifth one before they get bad, and that's only because Jai Courtney shows up.
Do you know what I really like about Die Hard? It's one of those films where you go, holy crap, that was 1988.
Yeah, it's insane.
It feels like maybe this is specific. It feels like a 1996 film. Like it feels before its time. Like that's how I think it's quite genre defining. I think it's like it's a milestone in the action genre. That you think that it's like when people say that Aliens was in the 70s, you're like, it was only just in the 70s, but you think that no, that's a staple 80s diet, and then the 90s was dominated by action, and you go, well, you look at Die Hard and go, yeah, okay, there are other action films coming out, but this really set the standard for, it's a tight script. The violence is like that. There's a lot of the violence, but it doesn't. It never feels
there's
mindless.
A lot of the violence.
Every like kill, every action is done for a reason.
Like when characters get hurt in it, like they get hurt, like. Every time something happens to John, like he carries that scar the rest of the film, like the broken glass in his feet and stuff like that. Like,
and it has the biggest asshole ever.
McClay.
in Richard. No, Richard Thornberry.
Oh, yeah. He's great, though, isn't he?
Yeah. I've always found Bruce Willis to be quite an underrated actor as well.
Yeah, he plays very well.
Well, he gets typed. No, it's not just that, though, because he plays what he plays. I mean, you look at his filmography and. In that time, yeah, you got Die Hard in there, but you know he shows up in Pulp Fiction. He's pretty good in Mercury Rising. Fifth Element's a good film. 12 Monkeys, he plays a very different type of character. Sixth Sense as well. You know, Over the Hedge can't be overlooked. It's just like I think he gets like because he was in The Expendables. He's like he gets put with like a lot of actors. Oh, they're just action. When you look at it and go, no, he was. Well, Friends is another example. You know, he has a good stock of films that people tend to forget he was in, but as you say, like he does like films for an hour now, doesn't he? He like shows up for an hour.
He has a contract, and he gets paid a specific amount for an hour. It's brilliant. He doesn't even shoot his own posters anymore. So there were two Bruce Willis films that came out this year where he was on the poster, directly taken from another movie poster he did a few years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic. And wasn't he? Didn't Sammy mistake him?
Sammy mistake him because we were in London and we see a Bruce Willis ad for an energy drink, and Sammy looks at him and goes, "Is that the guy from The Apprentice?"
Claude Littner.
Claude Littner.
Yeah.
Yes. Bold man.
No, he did look the same.
No, he didn't.
Yes, he did.
he looked like Bruce Willis. Because it was Bruce Willis.
Nah.
Yeah. And Bruce Willis has a lot of great roles. Friends, obviously. No, but he's never had a better role than Die Hard. He's so good in these. Even like the later films, when like he was already making films that he clearly didn't want to be in anymore. I always got the sense that like he did kind of want to be in Die Hard. Because like John McClane doesn't want to be there. So he's playing it as someone who doesn't want to be there. And like even when this franchise goes downhill, Mary Elizabeth Winstead shows up. So they're all worth watching.
Yeah, I think the use of the setting is really great as well. Like
Tony Plaza. It's
like you get a sense. You always get the sense of like where each characters are. Like you can't go down because the terrorists have taken over.
And they do that great.
Taken over the middle. The bottom
films do like Halloween or Home Alone, where like they show you the location before it all kicks off. So you've got like you've got a sense of where everything is all the time.
But you know, the bottom's completely taken up by that police guard, and it's heavily defended by lots of weapons. And then you're like, the only way they can go is up. But are they going to get? But the helicopter is waiting for. As soon as that helicopter comes, all the terrorists are going to go up the building. Like it's a really like tight hold. And then he loses his shoes with the glass on the floor, and the vest. Oh, and the scene where he meets Hans Gruber.
And Hans Gruber's like pretending to be like brilliant. A lost like American guy. Yeah,
yeah,
fantastic.
And it's just like. How often in these in films like do you literally get like halfway through the film you just get the good guy and bad guy just together like, both of which have loaded guns.
They don't spend much time like interacting with each other in this, but when they do, they bounce off each other so well. And this film, let's not forget, this film's so iconic that every film set like in a pretty confined location afterwards became Die Hard, but like Speed, Die Hard, but it's on a bus.
Like and then you get A.I. Powell's Al Powell's backstory as well, don't you? Where
he accidentally shot a kid. Yeah,
he shot a kid. Accidentally. I mean, he shot a kid, and it's like that comes up so much now. Like even today, it's still quite a relevant subject. The character work in this is just fantastic.
Yeah, and I like that he's forced in to being in Die Hard, being in the Die Hard situation, because like. The law enforcement that are out are all kind of like the lower just beat cops who don't go on the big things like him. Like he's been demoted and doesn't like do a lot of the active stuff anymore. And it's all people like that are out because the rest of the law enforcement is off celebrating Christmas at home.
Yeah.
So he's the one that's kind of got to show up to it. And then the guy falls on the car.
he had scenes deleted from Avengers Endgame.
Oh.
He was going to play a fireman.
Oh, he was, Catherine Langford. Was
he?
No, obviously.
Was he going to show up in the?
I have
was
a question.
Was he going to show up in the quantum? What's it called? The soul
imagine
plane.
If he showed up.
What was
showed
it
up as Tony Stark's daughter.
Yeah, was it worth it?
I have a question.
What did it cost?
Yeah.
How long do the Die Hard films maintain their Christmassiness?
Oh,
two's a Christmas film because he's snowed in an airport at Christmas. Again, he's trying to get home, but he can't because the airport's all snowed in. Third one is then after that, they're just not Christmas films at all.
Okay, so it's just the first two that are Christmas films.
Yeah, like the fourth one is just the sunniest like action film ever. Like it's set in a city, and every scene is just like too much sunlight.
Is the second one good?
Yeah, well, two and three are still both great. They're obviously not as good as one, but like then four's. Four's a good film. Five.
Not worth.
But
yeah, has Hans Gruber's.
No, that's three. It's three that has Hans Gruber's cousin in it. Two's just another villain.
Oh yeah,
has some proper like whoa moments.
Okay,
and it's a good bit where he goes down the conveyor belt, isn't it?
Yeah. I'll add it to my.
It's great.
Watch list
Christmas
this year.
List.
Right. Shall we move on to Reese's?
What best Christmas
one.
Film of all time have you picked?
I mean, I don't often like put my foot down for stuff, but I don't really care like other people's opinions on this one. And not only is this the best, I'd use the word greatest, and I'd use the word the most defining Christmas film ever,
and the best performance ever to be in a Christmas film.
Yeah, best performance ever. Yeah, I think the message is resoundingly universal. But anyway, I'll just say what it is. because we all know what it is. It's, of course, It's a Wonderful Life. It's one of those films, right, where for a long time, and you do this when you're young, to fit in and to have, you know, to have an image, particularly when you're in school and stuff. You say, oh, no, I'm really hard. I watch Star Wars. Ha ha. That's the only thing I watch. Anything else
I watch. Well, I watch It's a Wonderful Life.
I won't. And then, but then you, but then what happens is you watch a film like It's a Wonderful Life and your like entire view of, huh, these really popular people you're trying to impress, they're kind of stupid because they haven't seen this film. The sort of people who haven't seen this film are like, I pity them.
Yeah.
I pity people who haven't seen It's a Wonderful Life.
It also,
you have to have seen It's a Wonderful Life.
And not only that, it sort of turned me around on classic films as well, because I used to be very, I used to be a bit like pre-60s, yuck. And then like I watched Wonderful Life and I refused watching it for so long. So I was like, it's going to be old and cheesy. And then I watched it. I was like, that was bloody brilliant.
I've got two sides of notes and I'm going to list everything I love about this film.
Cool.
There is one scene that I define as my favorite scene in all of cinema.
Yeah.
And it's because it's a scene that I'd seen before years ago and I couldn't remember what it's from, and I'd watched loads of films which had similar scenes expecting it to happen and it never would. And then I finally saw this scene. I went to see this film in cinema with my parents and my sister. We went to see it in Chapter, and it was Christmas Eve and it was fantastic. And this scene happened, and it's the bit where they're dancing, right, and the floor opens.
Oh, and they all go in the pool?
The swimming pool.
Yeah.
I'd watched, and I thought, like, was that from Hairspray? Was that from Grease? Was that from, now I've seen so many high school movies, it could have been from Kissing Booth. It could have been from any of these films, right? And it's just like, no, and I saw it, and I was like, this is the funniest thing I've ever seen. I honestly, I love it. First thing I like, and it's just like, it had a connection. I just watched it, and you just sit there in silence, or laughter, and you just completely engulfed it. I think the black and white is fantastic.
Yeah, I don't. The color version sort of disappointing. It looks like a painting. It's so weird.
It's not worth watching. And secondly, it has this amazing effect on me. Only very few other films had. I take something like The Truman Show, and it's the question if you watch it and go, bloody hell, what if that was me? How would it differ if it was me? If I was taken out of that situation, would much change? The answer is of course yes, because we all have effects that go beyond we don't know. It's very poignant stuff. Lasso the Moon, love that scene.
Throw a lasso around and pull it down.
Ah, pull it down.
Pull it down.
She's naked in a bush.
Oh yeah, and then you get that you get that drawing as well of him lassoing the moon.
Yeah, but then you got like you know, he goes, oh, I want to go out the world. I want to build all these things and I want to make a difference and help thousands, millions of people. And you're like, him not doing that gets the same result. I think Clarence, what's his name, who plays him? Is it Henry Travis? Brilliant. I love the villain.
Mr. Potter.
Mr. Potter is so awesome, like as a villain. And you say with Batman, the reason why Batman's great is because he's got like these villains that push him to his limit. And, you know, when you get the bit where he says, he's like, wait, he wants to like take up all these like rich people, these poor people's houses and make them pay. And it's like, wait, do you know how hard it's for working men to like raise $5,000? Like, you know, the rabble he's talking about. It's like the working and paying and living and dying in this community. You know, how hard they work just to get like a decent rooms and bath, how much they'd enjoy it and like appreciate it. You're a warped, frustrated old man. You're their cattle to you. That's literally a film 75 years ago. Same issues today. Yep. And anybody who watches this film and watches that scene, you go, bloody hell, George Bailey.
Well, that's why
absolutely
this,
on the
it's
money.
One of the reasons this film is so timeless, isn't it? Because like it was made, it's in the 40s, yeah. But like every single like joke still lands, the character arcs still land, the themes are still relevant. So it's become so timeless, and it's why like every time they like there's rumors of a remake, I'm like just don't bother. You can watch the original and it still fits. There's not like I don't think anyone from now could watch this and not like relate to something in it. Because like George's like life of like, I want to go out there, I want to explore the world, I want to help people, but like we slowly see it like get slowly like chipped away, and like him like slowly get more beaten down by it. It's like it's not things like that haven't stopped happening just because 75 years have passed.
Who's there? It's George Bailey, mother. What's he doing? Why is he coming? Well, I was cold. He's making violent love to me, mother. I just love it. It's got little stuff like Zuzu's petals, which always come up. The every time the bell rings, an angel gets his wings. Yeah, oh, like nice iconic. Little that just this cut you in half. When he comes home drunk, or it's really like
hard to
scary.
Watch. Yeah,
because it's like the way he flips. Like, why have I had so many children? And he tells what's the name playing on the piano. On the piano. Just stop playing. Like, why are you playing that racket? And it's just, it's absolutely horrible to watch. And his descent before he meets Clarence, it's just like, okay, how's he going to get
and
this
ultimately,
one? And then,
he doesn't even...
And then, and the best thing about that, sorry. The best thing about that is that that's like, that's the bits of the film that people often forget. His descent into the madness.
Yeah.
That's the majority of the film.
Well, it's like,
bits where,
it's like
where
Home Alone, isn't
money.
It? Where people think of like the third act and think, and people who like have only seen it once a long time ago or haven't seen it but know about it, like, oh, that's what the whole film is. But there's so much more to the film than like the angel shows him life if he hadn't existed.
Yeah, because it's, I was surprised by this because I, obviously I'd not seen it until, what, like 2 years ago now, Mike-ish? And that was all I knew. It was like an angel basically showed him what life would basically be like if he'd not been born. And I thought that was going to be the whole film. So yeah, I was so surprised when like the first like 4/5 of it are just some guy living his life and trying to do the best he can and the best for everyone around him. But I was so enamored with it that I completely forgot it was coming.
That
and
it was
then
coming, yeah.
He,
but
and
the
then
build
he goes to, yeah,
so well,
it is like that. You get like emotionally whipped by this film.
But then like that third act is so good they managed to turn it around though. And it's like we were saying for Die Hard where they built where they like you get
yes.
out of the tower.
It's a Wonderful
so
Life
well.
And Die Hard.
How about I make the point
soon.
Loser? they because like you get like the layout of the tower so well. And in It's a Wonderful Life, they build so long like
the
going,
town,
like you get
the
layout of the town,
and
you get all the people, you get how George specifically has affected every single person and location in the town. And you get all of that so well that when you get a world where all of that's stripped away and his impact on those people is gone, his impact on those places is gone, you immediately, you can see.
Well, it's
the
not Bedford Falls anymore.
Because you
it's
see the
literally
bar and it's
another
residence.
Place. It's literally Potterville now. Like, it's not Bedford Falls anymore.
It's not Bedford Falls anymore. And you like, he just goes into the bar and you can straight away from the layout of the bar and the people in the bar, you go, oh, it's wrong. It's all wrong.
Yeah.
And you watching you already know the impact that it just had on people. Which is why it's so good that he hasn't. And like it's so upsetting because like you look at sometimes in real life where you look at people and think like maybe they could have done with like being It's a Wonderful Life.
George Bailey is so special that when he doesn't exist, it literally doesn't snow.
Yeah.
Like that's how significant his contribution to climate change is, that if he's not there, it doesn't snow.
In that alternate universe, Mr. Potter was 100% responsible for like climate change killing the world by the 50s.
Everyone always remembers the final act, the bits with Clarence. And I've already done this. I think the character of Mary is also really important to this because she's constantly there and she's his like motivation.
His rock in like every sense.
Because there's all these things that always keep him in Bedford Falls where he can go away. But at least there's like one good thing that.
Yeah,
like,
they're
like,
still
like,
there for
and,
him.
And it's sort of the balance, like, oh, his life is collapsing around him and he's really... But he's got, like, he slowly gets everything he wants anyway. He's got the house. You know, he's got
a loving family, children,
in his mother. You know, his brother, like, his brother's success hasn't really, like, affected him.
No, he's
like,
literally just happy for him.
He's got
and it's, like, the most humbling
the,
scene
yeah.
where he's like, everyone, look, I can't wait to tell you about how great my brother is. It's so heartwarming.
A really big point to that, and again, I stress that this is a 75-year-old film because these aren't themes that I associate with 70, 80 years ago, is that although everything on the surface is fine, deep down, he's breaking it. And constantly, he has this constant anxiety. You watch the way, you watch Jim Stewart's performance, it is a performance ridden with anxiety. And those great like monologue outbursts, those great bits where he does something erratic that like saves the whole town, that's a reaction to heavy anxiety of like he doesn't know what he's going to do next. He's really scared. Don't expect themes like that from an 80-year-old film. From a time, a film from a time where it was just after World War II. The big thing going around was shell shock and PTSD. And literally people getting called heroes, well, going to war, fine, they are. But they come back, oh, they're labelled, they're soldiers, they should be strong. Well, no, they've just been at war for 2-3 years. Like they're not okay under the service. They may wear medals and suits and hats and stuff, but they're not fine. And I think that's a really, really strong theme that people tend to forget. They always remember, what happened if you weren't alive? Well, but there's more to that than just the magic in it. It's a really important theme, I think, and it's why it lasts this long. And I think anybody can watch it, because you watch and go, God, I felt like that before. Maybe not as suicidal. Maybe not suicidal.
But that's the really like damning thing that kind of really like the last sort of twist of the knife for me is that he's not doing it because he can't cope anymore. He's doing it because this is the only way he can think of saving his family and the town.
Oh yeah.
He's not doing it. He's not giving up. It's just that this is the only solution he can see to the problems that have been presented, you know, that have sort of fallen in his lap by virtue of, you know, evils of man and just sort of damned misfortune. Like, and fully, James Stewart, already one of the greatest actors who've ever lived, gives his best performance here. He's just so good, isn't he? He's just so good.
Straight after World War, it was his first film after World War II as well. So all the Hitchcock films came after this, you know.
Definitely one of the most important films ever made.
Yeah, I agree with that. And again, I'd absolutely convince anyone to watch it, because as Mike said, it'll convince anybody who's a bit sniffy about old films to go actually give them a chance.
And then go and watch all of James Stewart's other films.
And you should get the Blu-ray that came out a few years back, because it's stunning.
Yeah.
It's like a nice silvery, snowy case.
I love a remaster. That's our favourite films covered. I'm gonna ask a quick trivia question, because it's Christmas and I want just a quick question. Don't have to give a fully answer. Mike, what's your favourite Christmas song?
Yeah. Oh, this year I've really turned around on "It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year."
Ooh, which version?
The original. I don't even know if it's the original. Let me tell you the one.
Is that Sinatra?
I will tell you the one I've been listening to. I don't actually know if it's the original. It's the one that was in the Hawkeye trailer, believe it or not. Andy Williams.
That rings a bell. Yeah. I do think that might be the original.
Good fun, isn't it?
Time of the year.
Sammy, what's your favourite Christmas song?
"Merry Xmas, Everyone" by Slade.
It's Christmas!
Yep, it's just like, I remember listening, this is, here we go, we got to mention, haven't we? I remember listening to it when I was a lot younger, and you go to the future now, and I was like, oh, the future, that's like time travel in Doctor Who, I love this song! so that was like a 7-8 year old perception, but as I listen to it more and more, like, obviously, that's not how I see that song anymore, but obviously I've kind of got those memories with it. And also, I do think it's just an absolute bop. I think there are some... I like a lot of the old, like, classics. Spaceman Comes Travelling, Fairy Tale in New York, all the I Believe in Father Christmas. Like, they're all great, but, like, Slade's Xmas Everyone just has that, like, little... That little history for me that kind of just brings it above.
What I love about Christmas songs is that, one, I have no shame when I listen to them. I don't care, right? I literally don't care. I watch it, I listen to them. People go, oh, you have to wait till December. Nope. As soon as I hear them on the radio, or as soon as I'm ready to listen to them, I'll put them on. And I love it. I like sitting in a workspace with headphones on, surrounded by other people, and you just know in your headphones, you smash it out, Slade.
See, I don't mind people celebrating Christmas privately before December. It's where it's being rammed down my throat in September that I start to get a little start to go off on one.
Yeah,
get the other best Christmas song of all time that we can all agree is a song for 10.
Oh.
When I woke up today,
failed to say.
Was a restless
phase. What about... Is that the only? That's not the only original.
No, there's
song
a "Love Don't Roam" was also, I think, a Christmas song.
Or it's "Christmas Is All Around Us" by Billy Mack.
Or what? It's not. Or this
Christmas is
in End of Time 2. End of Time Part 2 only briefly plays this. "Angel Got the Devil in Me," isn't it?
You got the devil in me.
Yeah. Anyway, Doctor Who was last week. Let's move on to some more films. Although I know not all of us picked films. So we've all talked about, what? Obviously, the famous ones.
No, hang on.
We haven't all picked films.
I thought we were someone picking changed. Underrated Christmas films.
Sammy, if you read the chat, you'd be aware of the reasoning behind it. But it's fine. We know you don't.
Read the chat,
it's fine.
So. anyway, because like there are lots of films out there that because of popular ones, people just don't like try. People often associate Christmas films with a certain theme and like a certain. It's got to be Christmassy in its essence. But there are lots of genres that try Christmas. One off the top of my head, something like Black Christmas, which free on YouTube. Go and watch it on YouTube. It's free.
You
on
watch
YouTube.
The right one because the other two watch are shocking.
Right. And you know, I just love the fact
is
that there's
1974
so
the original.
Yeah, and it has Lois Lane in it.
Yeah, it's anyway, got a great cast.
But it's just one of those things that you just watch it and go, why do they make this film? And if the answer is, well, it's Christmas. Love it. And I think all these personify that. I don't actually know what Sammy's picked. I'm really interested to find out.
We were talking about it just before the Zoom call.
Sammy, I've forgotten.
That's how underrated my Christmas film
anyway, we'll start with the person who hasn't actually even picked a film.
Okay, well, what I picked, technically not a film. It's technically a TV show, but it's 8 half-hour episodes. So technically, it's got the same runtime as Zack Snyder's Justice League. And that's... so,
and it has less Jared Leto.
I wanted to pick a Christmas Netflix thing because a lot of people may not be aware, but over the last 3 years, 3 or 4 years, Netflix have been building the MCU of Christmas movies.
Oh,
they've released just a ton of Christmas movies that are all set in the same universe.
Tell me you didn't.
And don't get me wrong, they are objectively shit. They are badly written. The performances, apart from Vanessa Hudgens, are awful. And they're like so cheesy. But I love those films. They're so... Yeah. Like, I know that I can put on any one of them and I can have a blast. And like get swept up in the Christmas charm and the cheese of it, no matter what they are. Princess Twitch, obviously the best trilogy in there. But the Christmas Prince sequels, A Night Before Christmas. But I decided not to talk about one of those films in specific. I decided to talk about a Netflix TV show they brought out about Christmas a few years ago that all of you guys, all of our friends, including Reese, told me to watch. And I was, because everyone was getting super excited about it. I was like, okay, this clearly seems like it's something special. Yeah. And I put it on, and I'll admit, first 5 minutes, I was thinking, these characters don't seem that likable. Really, like, the show that all my friends are, like, swept up with. And within about 15 minutes into the first episode, I was like, I love this world. I love all these characters. I love this. And I can't wait to see where it goes. And I'm talking about Dash and Lily. And I don't
disclaimer,
think enough people...
I've not seen Dash and Lily.
Well, we're going... Mostly
there's literally nothing
anyway.
To spoil
yeah,
about
it's, and it's and it's just so charming. And I know most people probably haven't seen Dash and Lily because that's probably why they bloody cancelled it. And I was really annoyed by that because they spent all year saying season 2 is coming. But like clearly they knew it wasn't because they would have made it by now to release this year. Bloody annoying. But it's just brilliant. And the basic concept is just one that alone, like even in the first 5 minutes, I was like, I'm not sure about these characters. The basic concept works so well. Because it's girls at a library. She finds on one of the bookshelves a diary where on the first page, there's a little note by someone looking for love. And they say, like, if you're into these sorts of things, then there's this. Solve this riddle. Write your own note. Place the book there. Then she solves it. She goes to where it. She puts the book there. She writes her own note. And that's Lily. Then we meet the guy, Dash. And he goes there and he gets the book and he gets her message. And it's sort of like them just like leaving the book around the sort of town, well, the city of New York. It's a pretty big one. I don't know if you've heard of it. And it's just them like leaving it there, leaving little notes, solving each other's puzzles and getting to know each other without really meeting. But then like as it plays out and like you both get, and at the same time you get their stories with like their friends and family and what they're all going through around Christmas and how it's like changing them. And it gets pretty emotional and like there's a lot of like really sweet stuff. The humor all lands. The characters, they all grow on you and they all work really well. And by the end, like when you're getting like the classic, like two characters don't know who each other are and they meet sorts of things. When you're actually getting like Dash and Lily, like crossing each other's paths a lot and you're like, no, just meet. And so it's so good. And, like the whole way through those notes just don't stop. And then when it leads to them, like finally meeting towards the end of it, it's just brilliant. It's such a good show. And it's only 8 episodes. I binged it in a day, and I'm pretty sure the rest of you did the same. And it's not often I binge like 8 episodes of a show in one go. But Dashing Lily, I just wanted to see more. I just wanted to see these characters do more things and go to more places and solve more riddles and fall more in love and joke about their ugly Christmas sweaters more and all of that. And it's just so sweet and wholesome and good. And I'm gutted that they cancelled season 2. And if I had the money, I would pick it back up myself.
Dashing Lily is, I watched it on a whim. Again, it was like that. It's the sort of limbo you go, oh, it's Christmas. I'll give the Christmas thing a go.
I think it was you and Chris watched it first, didn't you? And told the rest of us, give it a go.
I didn't realise Chris had watched it when I watched it. I'd just come off Never Have I Ever, which is another cool Netflix show. Definitely should go and check it out. It recommended it to me. I was like, I wasn't sure. It's all Christmassy. And you're right. The first episode is really cringy. And Dash is a massive prick. Like, I don't like Dash at all for the first few episodes. But then you mellow to him through the eyes of Lily. I think the two main cast are excellent in their roles.
Fantastic.
I think Austin Abrams and Midori Francis are, like, they do nail it.
And neither of them are, like, big actors either, are they? It's really, like, a big shame they haven't been in more, because they're both fantastic.
I've only seen her in Afterlife of the Party.
Which I still need to watch.
Yeah. And like I don't really mind there's not going to be a season 2 just because I think that the story... I think it did well enough to wrap the story up. And I think the cameos in the last episode really give it quite a gravitas for the finale.
Yeah, and it's weird because it's like... Because this is like a scale show. Then the person who shows up at the end is like... They're fairly
massive.
Big. Like...
Yeah, and so... But I do... I wouldn't mind more. I'm not that like...
If
there's never going to be any more.
This is the one season, this is it. I would have been all right with it. But the fact they said season 2's coming and then kept saying season 2's coming and kept saying season 2's coming and then went, we're not doing season 2.
Mike, this is the company that cancelled Dark Crystal: Age of Resistance, one of the greatest shows they ever made. And they continue to make Kissing Booth films. Like, don't get me wrong. We've ended the Kissing Booth trilogy. No way. There is a Kissing Booth 4 script somewhere. And do you know why there is? It's because it's not very hard to write a Kissing Booth script.
Reece,
literally,
Reece. More like
write
Kissing
an
Booth
narration.
Off.
It's like all they have to do is write the story and then the main... Then what's her name? Joe Page? What's her name? Joey King. Joey King can just read off the narration. There we go. There's the film. Go to California and dance on a dance machine or something.
All right.
Oh, and there's a thing that Dash and Lily does that other shows, because quite often something will be named after like two people, like Gavin and Stacey, and the two leads for some reason always have to be the weakest characters to let the side cast shine. But Dash and Lily's not like that. Like every character gets a moment to shine, and they're all carried by the main cast, and it's everyone's relationship with either one or both of the main cast members that really propels a lot of the charm in this. Because there's a lot of characters who do, like, who maybe not know both, but they know people who the other characters know. So, like, characters are constantly interacting with the same people. And, like, seeing how, like, their worlds, like, slowly collide without them even knowing it it's really well written. It's
Mike,
so good.
I have
yes.
a little teeny tiny challenge for you. So, as you know, I'm not... Rom-coms are not, like, my super go-to thing. So how would you pitch this show to me in a way that would make me want to watch it? Other than by just saying,
two people,
oh, it's so good, you got to watch it.
Well, it's so good, you got to watch it.
Ah, well, convinced.
Two people leave riddles for each other around one of the most gorgeous Christmas locations in the world for each other to solve and slowly learn more about themselves and each other as they do it, filled with Christmas charm, lovable characters, and it's so good you've got to watch it. And it's I think, Sammy, like, even without pitching it, I think seeing a show that I think there's 7 of us in our friend group that all watched it, and I think all of us binged it in a day, is pretty impressive.
When it comes to film and TV, I don't know if it's the same for you, the last year has literally like changed my view of
the last year has
television
been
and film
incredible
completely.
Like
the rom-com genre is a lot deeper and nuanced than any of us could ever
imagine. It ranges from utter shit to kind of shit.
No, that's because that's not the upper end of the range.
True.
That's an absolute lie. there are some fantastic rom-coms. Like, we watched Spontaneous, and we've spoken about it in one of the other podcasts. That is, for all intents and purposes, a rom-com. And it's one of the best films I've ever seen. Like,
the thing, particularly high school rom-cons, is that how many of the same film have we actually watched this year?
So many.
And so when you watch a film that's all about leading up to a prom, all the ones we've watched have been utter shit, yeah? A lot of them, right? But then you get, again, you get Spontaneous, which does it in a completely different way. Or you get She's All That.
Which is underrated.
Or even He's All That. And you know, the way they build up to the prom, and they do that prom scene, it completely blows your mind. Because they
I wouldn't say
like,
it blew my mind.
The characters they're writing. And it's just, it's such, it's, it, honestly, how I describe this, Sammy, is that you've got to find that one, don't you? You've got to find that one thing that convinces you this is what I want to watch more of. And I think I do actually believe that the way that Dash and Lily is set up, particularly the mystery as well, because the best thing about Dash and Lily is that they get the messages and stuff, but eventually you go, well, they're going to have to meet. When? How's that moment when they finally meet going to be? And that,
and
I think...
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I'm convinced that this could be the one that sets you off.
Yeah. Because I 3 years ago on Letterboxd, no, just over 2 years ago, made a ranking of all the main movie genres, and I ranked them all, and rom-com and romance in general were in the bottom four. There's 20 on the list. After the last year, I've moved them significantly up. They're now pretty much in the middle, and I know that's still not high, but what, because we mentioned it a lot on this podcast, we all watch rom-coms together on a Wednesday every week, and generally they've got Hilary Duff in them, so they're bad. But occasionally we come across a real gem on them. That's why it annoys me when people say we watch bad film, when we have bad film Wednesdays. Because I'd say there's a good 20% of those films that are pure gold that we have watched. And what the Wednesdays have done...
Yeah, but three of them you're thinking of are the spy films ones, and they're not rom-coms.
Hold on. Four of them.
and Sky High.
Sky High. But like, what it has done is raise my appreciation for like when you do get like a really good rom-com, how good it can be. Because watching a rom-com where they bring... Because a rom-com has to have two likable characters, usually, or it's just not going to work. And sometimes you get a rom-com where just the two characters you just fall so in love with that as you watch the film, like by the end, you're rooting for them. You're like, you're pumping your fists in the air, you're cheering.
See, and I don't think I've seen a romance or slash, you know, rom-com film where I've been that attached to characters. Like, Spontaneous was good, but do you know why I liked it? For the suspense, kids blowing up side of it, not the, oh, I really want those two to be together.
Yeah, but Spontaneous wouldn't have worked if the romance, or if the rom-com at the heart of it hadn't been so strong.
Yeah, but I didn't care about their relationship. That's
like
there
are,
wasn't an element.
There's other
was...
things as well that are sort of like sneaky rom-coms. Like Sex Education, one of Netflix's best
also,
shows at the moment,
seen.
That I think everyone sort of agrees with is excellent, is... pretty sneakily a rom-com.
Not seen, despite
not even
my one of my closest
not sneakily,
friends
yeah, it's like,
being
it's objectively
in
like heavily a rom-com. Sammy lived with someone who's in it, hasn't watched it, but yeah, and that's like that's a huge show at the moment, and it's
and it's a
rom-com.
I've not seen it.
Falcon and the Winter Soldier, classic rom-com.
Shall we move on to another?
Yeah.
Not television show. Come on, Sammy.
Okay.
Sammy, what should I watch? I've forgotten what you said originally.
I have chosen The Santa Claus 2, Tim Allen's sequel film as Santa Claus, in which, and bear with me here, Santa is un-Santa-ifying. He's becoming less and less like Santa Claus, and he has to go and get married, or his... he'll stop being Santa and Christmas will be ruined. And he's also trying to like raise his son from like the North Pole, and his son's acting out, and he's got a new like stepdaughter who's like so sweet, and his son's like, you know, I know my dad's Santa and I can't tell anyone that, and it's just like too much for him. And it's just, you have, as Mike was saying earlier, Tim Allen's great in this. But Tim Allen's better in this as evil robot toy Santa.
That evil robot toy has... It's really good. the prosthetics. I can't fault it.
It's so good.
One of the most horrifying things I've ever seen in my life. Every time it's on screen, I'm like, I do not want to look at this, but also can't not look at this.
There are two interesting things about this film. One is that it came out 8 years after the first. 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody was like, oh, how are we going to get money this year? I know, let's make the Santa Claus 2. Why have we waited 8 years to make this?
And not only that, a sequel that's made 8 years later as a cash grab, 0% of the time is better than the first. And Santa Claus 2 just barges in and makes, and I think Sam will probably agree with this, makes the best Santa Claus movie.
Yeah, it's it's so good. So the pitch to people who haven't seen it is Santa Claus is off basically trying to find his wife in a kind of rom-com-y kind of way. So that's the Earth stuff, like the non-North Pole plot. And then the North Pole plot is in order to make sure that like none of his elves find out that he might stop being Santa if he doesn't find a wife by Christmas. He makes a toy version of himself and brings it to life. And then that toy Santa starts just going completely overboard and like authoritarian. And it's just so good. But there are so many like little scenes in this, because this is one of the films that I had on video. For all those older listeners, of which there are three in this Zoom call. And so this would be the film that we watched every year, because this is what we had. It would be this and Mickey's Magical Christmas Snowed In at the House of Mouse, which is something I found on DVD a few weeks ago, actually. And I bought it ready to watch in Christmas.
That would be an excellent title. And I get it can't be already the title of a film. An excellent title of, like, where the banana splits, like, the old, like, children's... Yeah. Hosts got bought by a horror studio a few years back and got a horror like Banana Splits movie, and it was a horror slasher about some people who go to a filming of the Banana Splits and the animatronics go evil and kill everyone at the filming. That would be Snowed In at the House of Mouse would be a great title for a film where like a horror studio bought the rights to Mickey Mouse from Disney, and like some people go to like this hotel and get snowed in, and then like Mickey Mouse and his group of friends are all like evil trying to kill them.
Oh, yeah. Great title. So it's this and Santa Claus 2. And I watched this for the first time in about 10 years last year. And I was just shocked at, like, the amount of nostalgia and, like, just Christmassy cheer. Chet the Reindeer, who's just, like, an absolute legend. Blitzen, I think, gets fat. That, like, Santa plays, tinsel football with some elves, and they all just, like, pile up him, and then the toy Santa tries to copy him, and just absolutely wipes out the elves. He has no restraints. Like, no, I gotta win!
And doesn't it, like, one of the jokes from the first, and, like, do it in opposite as well? Well, like, the first has, like, obviously he's having to live his life, but he's getting, like, slowly Santa'd as he goes.
Yeah.
So he's getting bigger, like, his hair's going long and white.
He's grown a beard.
Then in this one, like, everyone's used to him looking like that. And then, like, as it goes, he slowly gets more Tim Allen.
I know the film is, like, a bit of a cash grab from, like, the studios. But, like, I think he came back because he was like, oh, cool, I get to be Santa again.
He had to stay being Santa. No one had killed him yet.
Yeah,
Santa until someone kills Tim Allen.
My one query about like the logics of this sort of universe of like Santa Claus is that you have to get married in order to be Santa. Okay, cool. If the Santa that he killed, what happened to that guy's wife in the first film?
She just became a normal person again.
That's just so bizarre. Like, I'm just constantly. Do they die?
There's a great like power struggle film to be made that is the story of like a Mrs. Claus who gets brought on by one of the Santas in this universe
and a new Santa Claus
and like is getting like so like high on their power as Mrs. Claus, and they're like getting worse and worse and worse, and then like a new Santa Claus gets made and they just lose all their power in one go, and then their power struggle is they like once they've lost it all. It's just the most like harrowing spin-off ever to be
fully
made.
Cast Lena Headey as Mrs. Claus
yeah
in that film
and Mark Addy as Santa.
Oh my god.
as the original Santa.
Yeah, and then Sean Bean as the guy that kills.
But like, there's so many like excellent lines in this. It's just like Evil Toy Santa starts making big toy soldiers to like reinforce his authoritarian rule, and it's just like, they need a little nudge. Let's call you the little nudge. And it's just like the way that he says it and delivers it in the film. Oh, I love this film. I can't fault it. For people who watched the first and weren't super into it because it was more legal drama than Christmas, I would say fully give Santa Claus 2 another go. And if you've seen the third one and were put off by that, this actually has plot and stuff in it. And it doesn't cram it all into like the final 20 minutes. So,
do you know what I've learned? I just learned now. Is that one of the songs that plays during the film is a Hilary Duff song.
What? Crazy.
Santa Claus Lane.
What a crossover.
The album as well. Yeah. Good she didn't appear.
She's in a Christmas film. In Search of Santa.
Oh, yeah. I've already forgotten she was in a Christmas film. Oh, God. Let's not go into that one again. So, my Christmas film. Well, I was initially—I was just trying to think, like what like genre-like breaking ones there were, and there were quite a few good horror ones. I really wanted to go into Anna of the Apocalypse. However, when I was looking over how I described the film, there is no way I can talk about the film without giving anything away, and I think it's a film that you have to go in cold. Apart from the fact. Yeah, apart from the fact that it's called Anna and the Apocalypse, that might give some things away.
There's a girl in it called Anna.
I want you. I say this now. I want you to go and watch it, and then we can talk about it.
Okay. It's on my list.
A little British film.
To watch this, yeah.
And so I thought, what other unique Christmas films can I talk about? And so I immediately went to A Christmas Carol, the most original Christmas film. Ever.
The Ross Kemp one, yeah.
But specifically, what version? Because there are some that are obviously a lot more prevalent than others.
That's what I was going to go to. So, the first Scrooge version I ever saw was Mickey's Christmas Carol.
Yes.
Which, as a child, I'm not going to talk about it much, which, as a child, harrowing. Because it's a horrible story if you're really young. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was
horrible
terrifying.
Story if you're really young.
Watch them get thrown in the pit at the end of the, not the pit, the coffin. Scary
I remember there was the one with Patrick Stewart in it. I remember that. The Jim Carrey animated
version.
I really like that one.
Yeah. I think you've got the Muppets one, obviously. I haven't seen that yet, but I've heard really good things about it. But the one that I enjoy the most. Oh, sorry, you even look to Doctor Who. You know, they did their own Christmas Carol. And
Ross Kemp.
It's Ross Kemp, and even to a certain extent, I'd say that even It's a Wonderful Life, very, very heavily influenced by the story of Christmas Carol.
I can see the inspiration. I wouldn't say that it presents itself at all.
But I don't think It's a Wonderful Life exists without Christmas Carol.
I think, Reese, if you've been enjoying The Muppets and you enjoy Christmas Carol, not even like the film itself, you're going to love, because you will, but just wait until you see the greatest Statler and Waldorf appearance of all time in that film. They're incredible.
And I know even more that I'm going to love that version, because my favourite version of Christmas Carol is a musical version. It's Scrooge from 1970, which it has Albert Finney as Ebenezer Scrooge. It was pretty cool. He's pretty fun, but it's a musical. The first time I ever saw a version of this was in the new theater in Cardiff. I went to see it on as a musical, and I have two very defining memories from that. Well, three. But Scrooge is played by Tommy Steele from the Steel Men, so I kind of like their old music. When you talk about movie monsters, and people go, "What's the scariest movie monster of all time?" You know, people might quote like the Alien. Stuff from what's Ghostface from Scream, maybe, you know, Freddy.
I mean, it's objectively Pennywise, because he can turn into whatever.
No, it's not. It's not, because because the scariest monster in movie history, and all of fiction, I'm standing by this now, is the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come.
Yeah, terrifying.
There is not. I've never seen a version, or maybe I haven't seen the Muppets yet. I've never seen a version of that character where I've not been absolutely petrified by. And that goes all the way back to Mickey's Christmas.
Oh,
and his description in the book as well
is fucked up.
Like, yeah. Horrendous.
And I have two harrowing memories of why it's the scariest thing. One on the stage, right, well, this is quite a simple one. There was a bit where like Scrooge says, "Show yourself," and he drags the cape and there's nothing under it. He rips the robe away and there's nothing under it. Then he appears behind a door and like I jumped. But the next one is that during the bit where they explore like hell or whatever, I was sat up in the box, like on the side. I was looking down, I could see there were like figures moving around the audience as it was going along. Like, oh, look, all these ghouls. And honestly, someone touched me on my shoulder. I turned around and there was one stood there. And it's the first time I've ever screamed in public. Like, it just literally. And it was the scariest thing I've ever experienced. And it's stayed with me, that one. But then there was a film version of this, which the musical was based off. And it's just
Alec
like
Guinness?
Has Alec Guinness as Bob Marley. Jacob Marley. And it's just like, it's properly old school. And everyone cast in it is like the perfect version of who they could have. Kenneth Moore as the Ghost of Christmas Present is just a fantastic. He's like, it's green screened in a way, so he's like massive. And he has a great, the I Like Life song, which is fantastic. And he drinks the elixir of human joy and stuff. All the songs are great. It has Edith Evans, who plays the Ghost of Christmas Past, who I think is a representation of his sister in the future. I'm not sure. I remember in some versions that character is a candle. I've seen the wax dripping down. I love Edith Evans just simply because of the fact that I've shown you this clip multiple times of her in The Importance of Being Earnest. Handbag. I just think she's a fantastic. I love her. Mr. Feswick has a great song, December 25th. I'm really disappointed that more people haven't seen this film. Just because for me, Scrooge is like, it's the perfect musical version of this film. And if you've seen the Muppets Christmas version, you can see its heavy influence in it. I'm sure, being a musical and the comedy.
I only just remembered that there's another one of the films we spoke about today. There's a Muppet version of. Did you know there's a Muppet, It's a Wonderful Life?
Is there?
There's a Muppet, It's a Wonderful Life. It's only a short, and it's become pretty infamous because there's a big like mess up in it at one point. Because it's Kermit gets It's a Wonderful Life. Then they take him to a like world where Kermit never existed. And one of the first things they do when they get there is they do a panning shot of the skyline of New York. But they use stock footage from pre-2001. And the Twin Towers are still there. So it's canon in the Muppets universe that something Kermit did caused 9/11, which is...
There was one Christmas Carol version I forgot to mention, which was the Blackadder version.
Oh fantastic. So such a brilliant twist of like, every Christmas Carol is, he's horrible and he's got to get nicer. Love the Blackadder's is, he starts like as nicest in the world and he has to become the worst. So clever.
Another casting in this film, you'll like this, Mike, or maybe you won't. Mordrin from Mordrin of Dead, it plays
nice.
Bob Cratchit.
Nice. I like Mordrin of Dead.
I really like musicals. I think I like musicals a lot more than you. I've watched a lot more than you two. I think just for sheer like exposure from family, and I actively search them out. In the last month, I've gone through Annie, I've gone through Oliver and Grease. I've done the whole lot this
have
last
you seen
month.
Annie 2014?
Yeah, I have. I saw it in cinema.
I quite liked it. I thought it was better than people give it credit.
Better
for.
Than the 80s one.
Bruce, what year did this
What
year did this Scrooge come out?
1970. Albert Finney. And it's that classic musical, like, do you know in Oliver where...
You said 1970. I thought 1970, and I wrote 1940.
Yeah, but nice. it's like...
There probably was one.
Do you know, like, old, like, musicals? And there's always a song where literally everyone is just walking, like with their arms flapping everywhere, yeah. And that's the dancing. Everyone's just walking back and forth. It's like the big ensemble, everyone on a big set, stood in a massive studio, just da, 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 da. Oh, thank you very much. It's an absolutely fantastic film where fantastic scene where the Ghost of Christmas Future yet to come shows him like the future, and everyone starts like doing the song where they're thanking Mr. Scrooge. It's thank you very much. Nicest thing they've ever done for me. And they're all dancing and they're all celebrating and he's doing it as well. And what he doesn't realise is that they're celebrating his coffin going to the grave.
Yeah.
Hmm. So they're like, yay, excellent. Like, yeah, thank you for dying. Like, this is all they're
I love when like Scrooge versions do a thing like that though, where they do something that like you haven't really like seen before. Like, because they... Christmas Carol has been told so many times now that, like, generally, you know what it's going to be. Which is why when you hit a point where you're like, oh, I wonder what this is. And they're like, they hit something that surprises you. It works so well. Because, like, is there any story that's been told as many times as A Christmas Carol?
No. No. There are literally millions of versions of it.
And let's not forget, the only reason it exists is because one day Charles Dickens was at the theatre and some gas beast from the void, some gas beast from the rift comes out of a corpse.
Ooh,
yeah, and he goes, Ghosts at Christmas. How preposterous.
That reminds me, there is also another film. There is another film that there's The Man Who Invented Christmas, which is like a biopic of how like Charles Dickens wrote this book. It's quite good, actually.
Are there any ghosts
in it? No, like how he got the name Ebenezer Scrooge. Like he found a gravestone, like just in like the back alley, and he just liked the name Ebenezer Scrug or something, I think it was. And he just loved it. And like the way he built the story, because he didn't like write novels in fulls, did he? He wrote them as like
chapters to go in like the newspapers.
They released in parts of like
They were released in parts, and this absolutely like exploded. And like stuff like Bar Humbug and like the setting of. And the setting of like the nasty accountant, because that's where he worked a lot of his life, Charles Dickens, as like an accountant.
Yeah.
Under people like him.
Hold on.
Fantastic. And it's got Dan Stevens as Charles Dickens.
Oh, nice.
So, solid.
Don't forget though, people aren't called Ebenezer anymore. That's what the modern versions of Christmas Carol often forget. They keep him as Ebenezer, whereas the Ross Kemp one was smart enough to rename him Edward Scrooge.
Ugh, that is fucking gross.
Do you know what? That is a Christmas Carol version I need to see as well.
In Ross Kemp's Christmas Carol, he was a loan shark.
A loan shark.
Because what else is he going to be in 2005?
What was he selling PPI? You need to repay your payment.
And also, because I read this for the first time, I read Christmas Carol for the first time last year. Genuinely, like, a really cracking book. Like, there's a lot of, like, famous books and people say you should read, but there's a lot of them are just, like, full of waffle and just, like, unnecessarily...
And racism.
And just, usually. Like, Dracula, Wuthering Heights, Pride and Prejudice. Like, they're all just... You know, like, I can see why they're, like, iconic and famous, even if they're, like, still not actually that good. But, Christmas Carol, genuinely cracking book.
Yeah, I'd say that for a lot of... I say that for a lot of Charles Dickens as well.
Horrifying as well, though.
I loved it. I love the David Copperfield. I think it's fantastic.
And there's still some stuff in the book that like a lot of the film versions just don't really include.
Yeah.
Like
did the Guy Pearce version include a lot of that?
No, the Guy Pearce version made Scrooge a sex offender.
Yeah.
No.
He's like no longer like wanting to be redeemed. Like
Well, no, he was, but he was also a victim of it as well, so that makes it.
Yeah, only last year.
Yeah,
that was
like,
only last year.
Was
yeah.
that the? It was only last
Shocking.
Year.
I remember disappointing.
I watched the first episode with my mother, and then I watched half the first episode. I had to tell her I can't watch this anymore. I'm so bored.
Like it wasn't just boring. It was also just properly bad. Like when he. Brings like is it Mary Cratchit when he brings her in and pays her to take her clothes off and then is like I just wanted to see how far you were willing to go for money. It's like I no longer want you to be redeemed. I don't care about when you're happy on Christmas Day and like giving them money because you're a sex pest. I don't want you to be redeemed by ghosts anymore.
And also there are three ghosts that visit him after Marley, you know, very famously the three ghosts, and they spend like 2.5 episodes on one ghost, and then they're like, "Ah, oh, shit, the other two.
They're poor, and
no one likes
isn't
you."
Isn't there a bit where like
that always?
Isn't there a bit where Mary does like a magic spell or something, and then she's able to see Scrooge and the Ghost of Christmas Present when they're like walking around.
I hate that version of, because like the whole point of Bob Cratchit and his family is that he's there to show Scrooge like just directly how negatively he's impacting people, whether he realizes it or not. With like,
and they're the anti Scrooge.
His wife doesn't need to be a character in this.
They have
like, at all
no money, and they're. And like everything is going wrong for them, and they're still a loving family having fun on Christmas. Whereas Scrooge has all the money, by all intents and purposes, current day, everything's going fine for Scrooge. But he's a miserable sod, and he doesn't let anyone in. And they're like they're the anti-Scrooge, and it's him seeing them and how he negatively impacts them, but how they can carry on anyway is a huge part of like impacting.
And
his Scrooge.
Like nephew as well.
So they add such like disgusting to it.
It's amazing me how many ways they portray that message as well. Like there's always in all these versions there's always a distinct right which bit is better. Is it the bit with the past ghost, the present, or yet to come ghost? Like they're all different versions I've seen. Like for me, the Patrick Stewart one, when he goes into his past, it's really moving because you meet his sister and how he grew up in that horrible house and how he was abused. But then in this version of Scrooge, I love the Christmas past bit because Kenneth Moore is brilliant, and he like the whole thing about the Christmas present, sorry, is that he's like he only lives for a day, and he's all full of life, and it's all full of
I think that's the thing with like a lot of the ghosts of Christmas present. Where...
And then I remember the animated one where he like literally turns into bone, or like ash, and he gets destroyed in front of him.
That's horrifying.
Every time,
that laughing skeleton is just.
Yeah,
hideous.
And then like I said, Ghost of Yet to Come, scariest thing in everything I've ever seen. There has never been anything as scary as the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come. Can't stand it.
I don't know. There could be another Hilary Duff Christmas film on the horizon.
Yeah. Do you want to know, Chris? Do you want to know, Reese, how you make Bob Cratchit even more sympathetic?
Do you turn me into Kermit Frog?
Because no one wants to see Kermit sad. I don't want to see Kermit having a bad Christmas.
They're always the worst Muppet films, as far as I can see so far. Whenever Kermit is sad.
Because you don't want Kermit to be sad. You want to walk around and have a
The saddest thing in that film is Tiny Tim in Muppet Christmas Carol is like harrowing.
It's like a little Kermit.
It's harrowing.
But is it his nephew?
No, it's his...
Kermit's nephew, yeah. Because he's in... He's in the Muppets movie, isn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, get ready for the exorcism. Should I stand up? Should I put my hand over my heart? Nope. I love that.
Anyway, just random ones people want to shout out without a massive...
Snowmageddon!
No.
Batman!
Me and my family every year have to put Snowmageddon on. It's like
Reese hasn't talked enough about Christmas Carol.
Have some questions about Christmas.
Okay. Hold on, I want to just throw Snowmageddon out there. It's an asylum-style Christmas horror film about a girl who gets gifted a snow globe that's also her town, and every time she shakes it, it causes a natural disaster in her town. Multiple scenes in the summer, so there's no snow for a lot of it, even though it's called Snowmageddon, and then they'll cut the camera and there will be snow. Characters split up and go on adventures, but then, like, in the next scene they'll be together, and then the next scene they'll be split up again, back in their other location. It's the most incompetent, bad Christmas horror film, and every time I put it on, I am giggling like a lunatic because it's so funny. Snowmageddon.
Okay.
That's all.
I will finish with this question. Sammy, what's your dream Sunday dinner plate?
Like the actual plate itself or like the food to go on it?
What the f*** do you mean? What the fuck do you think?
Well, you said my dream plate, like
your plate
of
dinner.
Food, obviously.
Well, why don't you just say dinner? What's your dream Sunday dinner?
Sammy, you're the only person who's ever had an issue with it being asked like that.
No one else has ever asked me
A plate of food. Hang on. A plate of food. A dinner plate of food. Your Christmas dinner plate. What's your Someone brings you a Christmas dinner plate.
I'll go. I'll go because Sammy's a fucking lunatic.
No one else has ever asked me a question like that.
You got to have a few slices of turkey. Got to have a Yorkshire. I feel like your veg has got to be stuff you don't usually have. Maybe some like honey roasted parsnips, stuff like that. Obviously some roast potatoes there. It is very Monmouth. Obviously you got to have gravy. You have to have cranberry sauce for the turkey.
Gotta have it.
Yeah.
Can't be without it.
Yeah,
you've missed the most important thing. Stuffing. You've got to have stuffing.
Oh, yeah, stuffing. No, no. Have to have stuffing.
Stuffing's which good. Here in the UK, we don't stuff into things.
Yeah, we literally just have it. We literally just mix it up and put it in a bowl, and I would like happily eat a bowl of it. Like, it's so good. It is so good.
Oh. Yeah, when I did eat like meat, is that what we used to do? Is our local curry Indian place? Our local Indian would do the whole menu with turkey, so you get a turkey Buna, a turkey Madras, turkey whatever. I used to have a butter turkey. With all the bits and sides, we used to eat that on Christmas Day.
I like to gather up turkey, reese it into like a sandwich the next day with like a slice of turkey, slice of gravy, and then a slice of turkey again. And then I like to put it in the fridge at work. When someone eats it, I like to absolutely lose my mind. I call it the moist maker.
Do you know what the best? If you haven't done this, I highly recommend it. Is you get your Yorkshire.
That was
you dice up some
sandwich.
You basically cook your Christmas dinner as you normally would, but you dice up like your potatoes and your carrots and stuff really small, and you put them all in a Christmas in a Yorkshire pudding, and then you just have the Yorkshire pudding, but you have like a little bit of everything in the Yorkshire pudding. It's like a whole mini dinner in one. They're delicious.
Oh, I always fill the Yorkshire with gravy. Well, I love seeing that like first slice where you slice the edge of the Yorkshire off and watches the gravy like flies out.
Oh, no, fully, but you've got to have more than one Yorkshire pud. I think there's enough room for two puds.
Oh, enough room for two puds. I love your Yorkshire pud, don't you, big boy?
No, I do like my Yorkshire. Oh, little bit of cranberry sauce, little bit of gravy. Made it from stock, mate. You ever had stock? Oh, fuck, it's sick.
I always associate them with beef, and so I typically wouldn't have them with, if I didn't have beef with my dinner, so I probably wouldn't have it at Christmas. I like cauliflower cheese. I like time and time again. I know Mike's going to say something here, but I will say this. For me, every Sunday dinner has always been defined, if there's a bad cauliflower cheese, it's a bad Sunday dinner.
Yeah.
And so it's just one of those things you have to get perfectly right.
A good cauliflower cheese can be a highlight of your plate, but a bad cauliflower can ruin the entire meal.
Yeah.
And the issue is, a lot of cauliflower cheeses are really bad. Like, you never know if you're going to find a good one. The Wetherspoons cauliflower cheese tastes like feet.
Anyway.
And on that uplifting note, Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good cauliflower cheese.
All I say is goodbye to Mike.
Bye.
And Sammy, goodbye to you. And go and watch Hawkeye.
I'm going to watch it.
Ash and Lily.
I'm going to watch it.